This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit is brought to you by you, the listener. We're at the end of 2012, preparing for a whole new year of podcasting adventures. And of course, our Hobbit podcast will be in our, well, most important list of shows that we produce because we love doing this. The thing is, we need your help to be able to continue. We have our costs for running the organization, paying for our servers, and that is why we dare to ask for a little bit of support if you are able to do so. Now, if you appreciate what we do and you want to give us a hand in continuing to do this in 2013, then I would like to invite you to go over to sqpn.com/donate. That's where you can find all the information on how you can help. It's sqpn.com/donate.
sqpn.com presents The Secrets of the Hobbit.
There and back again. A Hobbit's Tale. Bilbo Baggins. Now, where to begin?
Hello and welcome back to a new episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit. And, well, a lot of people were laughing last week because we were trying to get through our review of the Hobbit movie, the first one. The Unexpected Journey, and we kind of hoped that we would at least get out of the Shire. Turned out we hardly got out of Erebor with our discussion, so we're just going to be courageously continuing our endeavor. It is kind of an unexpected journey, recording a podcast like this, but we will try to at least get to the end of the movie in the next two episodes. Joining me today, just like last time, are two of my resident Hobbit experts, Tolkien fans, and so many other qualities that I won't mention here on the show. Otherwise, I'll have to probably raise their wages. Joining us all the way from California, Dave Kill. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Father.
Woken up by the smell of coffee. This is not even first breakfast time for you, right?
That's right. Second breakfast. What I'm really woken up by was just the sheer desire to keep talking about The Hobbit with you guys.
Excellent. Well, also joining us today again is Inge Lotz. It's kind of, is it 11 C's or what is the Hobbit equivalent of how late it is in the Netherlands right now?
I have no idea.
It's probably first or second coffee or...
Yeah, I do know if I look outside, that's over the Misty Mountains cold. It's really Misty Mountains white and cold outside. So
we don't have mountains in the Netherlands, but we do have mist right now.
Yeah.
Perfect weather to talk about this movie, which, of course, for at least part of it, takes place in the Misty Mountains. And last time, as you recall, we finished our discussion about the prologue and about the whole history of the dwarves. We are brought back by Peter Jackson to the Shire because the moment that Bilbo is done explaining or writing down the history of the dwarves and why that mountain Erebor is so important to them, we go back to Frodo. And Frodo is heading off and Bilbo is there. And just before Frodo heads off, he attaches the little sign about the upcoming 111th birthday party of Bilbo Baggins. We get the small reference to the treasure, the chest with silver and gold that Bilbo, in one of the future films, is probably going to dig up in that cave, and that is still there in Bag End. And then, refresh my memory, because I've only seen the movie three times, but what happens next? we get, of course, we merge to 60 years before the 111th birthday of Bilbo. So all of a sudden we discover him sitting on that same bench smoking his pipe. And then a gray man arrives who searches, who looks for someone who is in for an adventure. Gandalf the Grey. Dave, what do you think about Gandalf in this movie?
You know, it's kind of a lot of the feedback I've heard from folks was that they kind of enjoyed the return to Gandalf the Grey as opposed to Gandalf the White, you know, sort of the more kind of more irreverent, more irascible, kind of more down to earth as opposed to lofty Gandalf. And Not that I have a problem with Gandalf the White. I always love that transformation, and I love seeing him sort of get his due in terms of being revealed as sort of a, you know, a great lord. But I really enjoyed him in this film. I don't know about you guys, but I was really excited that they included the little exchange about good morning. That was awesome.
Yes, I loved that.
It was quite a surprise because that is kind of you can write that down, but I was very skeptical as to whether that would work in film. But the delivery was so well done by these two actors that I thought it was actually more fun seeing it in the movie than reading it on paper. And actually, it was one of the things that struck me most about this first movie is that the best jokes, the funniest moments of the movie are straight from the book. And it's stuff that once I saw it acted out, I thought it was funnier than it ever appeared to me while just reading the book. And it's just probably because I've got a lousy sense of humor, but I really love that. The whole theater was laughing about jokes that Tolkien wrote down so many decades ago. It's the strength of that narrative that still works. But I have to say that the acting is perfect. And Gandalf is kind of the only character that wasn't artificially youthened up, or, you know, his hair, his beard, everything still looks the same. Whereas all the other actors were slightly younger. Even Saruman looked a lot younger, probably just because he had a little bit of a darker beard. But Gandalf the Grey, I guess, been always this grey.
Yes. Would you think of the fact that they kind of connected the way they connected the beginning of this film with the beginning of the Fellowship of the Ring?
In what sense?
Well, they clearly, I think we might have touched on this a bit the previous episode. Jeez, I can't even remember. But the fact that it ends exactly where the other film begins. I know there's some complaints people have had about you know, Bilbo starting writing the book that day, but I really like that. I think that was a great touch for films of the other fans and stuff.
I personally didn't really mind. I think it worked. It's probably different from the book. I don't remember exactly, but to me it's kind of makes sense, and it ties the two movies together. So I wasn't really bothered too much by it.
Yeah, what I wondered was that whole good morning thing, if it was enhanced by the fact that both actors were British. Because it's very British humor.
Perhaps it is. You might have a point there. It seems a bit like, it's great, isn't it? Yes, it is, indeed. That's kind of...
Yeah, just a little bit has this feeling. And of course, both actors being from... I think they are both from Great Britain, right? That they have a more natural attachment to that. And that's easier for them to deliver the joke because it's... Yeah, close to their heart.
I think the entire endeavor of filming these three movies would have been a disaster if you'd only had American actors. I don't think it would have worked. An American Bilbo? It just doesn't work. the next thing we see, of course, is this very famous scene where Bilbo is reluctant, and the only thing he wants is to get rid of this gray old man, even though there's a bit of a shock in his eyes when he realizes that it is that same Gandalf that he used to know as a child. But then when he closes the door, you get that famous scene where Gandalf is writing that rune on his front door. Was that the way you imagined it to be? In when you read the book,
pretty much, yeah. A lot of those kinds of things they really did. You know, they're pretty. They stayed pretty true to how it worked in the book, and the dynamics of the scene weren't exactly right. You know, like with Bilbo kind of listening in and stuff. But I think they.
I actually thought that was a great scene, a great addition. It's like, oh, what is that scratching noise? And
yes,
you don't know exactly what is happening. And I thought it was just brilliant, just visually. And I remember seeing a photo of Bilbo listening to the door, which is actually probably from a different take on the scene, because you see the entire door and him just listening. Whereas in a movie, I paid attention. You only see him like filmed from the side when he's putting his ear against the door. And I was wondering about the rune itself that Gandalf paints or scratches, or it's kind of almost like a magical thing that he does with the glitter. Is that what kind of sign is that?
I think it's a G-rune. It's his name. So that's the same kind of rune. He also carved on the stone on Weathertop.
Oh, you think?
But I'm not completely fluent in the alphabet. It could also be something
Me
else.
Me neither.
But, but yeah, that was my first... how I recognize it as being a G-rune.
Fascinating.
I don't know, Dave?
They must have researched
it. I'll be honest with you. I'm not quite sure. What it's supposed to be... is it was supposed to be in the book, what it is it's a mark that's sort of universally understood to be an advertisement by a thief or burglar looking for work.
Oh.
And that's in the book, there's this conversation about, you had the burglar advertisement on your door, and Bilbo's like, what are you talking about? And in the movie, they didn't really get into that. They just said you had the mark on your door. So I'm not sure what it was meant to mean in the movie. I'm looking at that the transcription website, trying to see if they discuss it, but I can't find it. I'm not too sure about that.
It kind of looks like a symbol for a key or something like that, but it might have just been made up. I always imagined just a big X on the door, like X marks the spot. But this is a little bit more.
That's not a franchise, Father.
Middle Earth like. The next thing we see,
not X-Files.
Of course, yeah, the X-Files, is the entrance of the dwarves, and we've seen lots of small parts of this whole sequence that takes place inside Bag End in either in production movies or in production videos and in the various TV spots, etc. Still now seeing the entire sequence, I personally thought it worked really well, even though it was an abbreviated version of what we read in the book, especially with the last few dwarfs that all tumble over each other. I think it's probably the only thing you can do to not make it too long. Inga, what did you think about that scene of all the dwarves arriving one by one?
Yeah, it's very much like the book because and it also is—it's a trick he uses more often, Gandalf. So he uses—you see the in the book that, for example, when the trolls are investigated, they also go one by one or two by two. Mm-hmm. And later in the book, when they visit Beorn, the shapeshifter, then they also go two by two because if they would come all at once, they would get rejected. So it's kind of a theme you see. As a red thread through the whole book.
It's a strategy to introduce the dwarves in a non-threatening way, I guess. What I loved about this scene was, again, the humor and how well it worked. Just that first surprise on Bilbo's face, and he's sitting there, he's trying to hide this one muffin or whatever it is that he baked and trying to keep it for himself. And then was it Dwalin? It's Balin and Dwalin, the first ones that enter, right? And then you understand that they're brothers, and then who are the two young ones that arrive? Is it Fili and Kili?
Yeah. Yep.
I love that scene where, is it Kili who tries to remove the dirt from his boots on Bilbo's treasured, the bride chest of his mother?
Yeah.
Like, that was such a funny detail. That is not in the book, but it was so hilarious.
The dwarves were really dwarfish, and that's because they're kind of rude, kind of crude, almost. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of Bilbo is like, what's happening? And he's trying to kind of crisis management everything.
Well, you can see that there's in Bilbo is almost like a conflict of values in him, because he, as a hobbit, he needs to be hospitable. He needs to, you know, serve people tea, etc. But at the same time, this completely uproots his entire lifestyle. And so it's stretching the boundaries of his of his hospitality, and you can see him just gradually losing it, and you're just waiting for that big explosion where he can't take it any longer.
Exactly, and I was just waiting for him to struck by lightning, and it didn't come, and I was like, oh, come on, I just wanted that to be, that's just...
I think the good morning exchange was stretching the general movie going audience's patience enough. I think the struck by lightning thing, people have been like, what the heck is
would have been over the top. Yes, but
they kind of part of whole sequence. I was like, that's why in a book where I have to laugh, because that's exactly the Hobbit version of a mental breakdown. So
yes.
Like, although you see it in his
painting
eyes.
Painting thing was kind of the modern take on that.
Yes, trying to contain himself and as, no, it's not working. Boom. And then there was this other lovely moment before that where, you know, just Balin and Dwalin are trying to find food in his storage room, and he's like, I'm sorry, and then apology accepted, and then it just continue. That's brilliant. I thought it was a really nice this was almost like a reinterpretation of the entire scene, but it felt very much like something that Tolkien could have written, I think. We're not talking about a very essential story element here that has changed, but it had the same vibe to it. It's just these rough dwarves. And then that total surprise, and then it must have been so hard for Bilbo to process all this, and he can't.
And the song, that's what Bilbo Baggins hates.
That was great. I didn't expect that, because I remember in one of the production videos seeing them throwing around the plates, but I thought it would be more like a food fight and that they would break everything. But instead, it is this almost like modern acrobatics that takes place in his kitchen. And I love the song. Actually, the last time I saw the movie, I noticed that the songs were composed by someone else. This is not Howard Shore. This is, I don't know. It's like all the songs are composed by one person. But I think it was well done. It sounded believable as a song. I'm not sure about the whole sequence of them juggling around all the plates. That was a little bit too, you know, special effects-like to me, but it was kind of fun.
I enjoyed it. I do think the dwarves presented in this film seem much, much less kind of bumbling and oafish than Gimli did in the Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
I guess it's maybe because they're not constantly being used, played off against, a graceful elf or the kingly Aragorn as humor. But these guys tend to be, when you watch them like that, they tend to be much less sort of comedic humor. Like, you know, they seem very, very, very sort of quick, agile. You know, they're doing all these fancy tricks at the plates and stuff. Later on, they're fantastic in battle, and that was something that I was first struck by during this scene, that these dwarfs are not kind of the bumbling oafs that Gimli was.
No, and I was expecting a lot more slapstick humor, and I'm glad that wasn't the case, because it made them feel much more real in a way. I don't know if you can say that of a group of dwarves, but it did feel like, this works. I can believe that these characters are all going to play, you know, major roles in the story. It's not just a bunch of, you know, it's not a whole group of just there for comedic relief. Even though there were some very funny scenes in there with the cheese there is this one shift in the whole atmosphere, which I think was also very well done. This whole scene in Bag End could have been like, every scene could have been the same contrast between Bilbo and the dwarves, but the mood changes the moment Thorin arrives, and all of a sudden you see that all the other dwarves have, you know, high esteem for Thorin, and it gets much more dramatic, and you feel that with the introduction of Thorin, the story also introduces us to a different level. And it gets more grim, and there's this whole discussion about the other dwarves and whether they would join them or not. You know, the dwarves of the Iron Mountains, and like the whole group is like, will they join us? And then no, we have to do this by ourselves. And again, I was wondering if this is something that Tolkien also included in his story, or if this is something that they just kind of inserted there.
That's something that I, to the best of my
crickets.
Knowledge, was filled out from the where they kind of departed a bit from the books. I actually really like that change, and there may be if we go back and read Quest for Erebor and the Appendix of Lord of the Rings and Unfinished Tales, that there might be there's probably stuff in there that you could say plausibly sort of points in this direction, but I don't recall there being a huge discussion between Thorin and any other of the characters, dwarves or Gandalf, about a meeting at Eren Luin where he went and actually asked for help on this. I think all along the plan was to take actually a small company and do this. The feeling was that assaulting the mountain with an army wouldn't have worked. But I really like this idea because what it did was it kind of, like, in the book you just sort of get the sense that these dwarves just kind of show up and that this was the plan all along, and you know, there's no particular reason for these dwarves to be here. What this does is it really highlights this idea that these dwarves were sort of the coalition of the willing, if you will.
Right.
That Thorin did put out this call for help, and that nobody came except these dudes. And it's sort of, because otherwise you're left with the impression of, like, really, you know, Thorin's the king under the mountain, and this is the best that he could do. These goofballs. Like,
well,
especially because we've
just seen that long prologue with, you know, and we have seen how many dwarves are chased away. This scene is I think makes it very clear to us as, you know, people that only know this story that, well, they're really on their own right now, and there's a reason for that. The other dwarves are a bit like the elves. It enhances that feeling that Thorin must have had, that, you know, everybody abandons him.
Now he's
getting coupled to this strange Bilbo that, you know, is not at all what he expected and certainly not what he needed.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, and I liked that change. In fact, I would say in general of all the things they did in the film that I think worked well, my favorite thing was this recurring kind of theme or storyline of these dwarves being the ones who showed up.
Yes.
You know, they're not as Balin says, they're not necessarily even the best or bravest or most skilled or smartest. Although they're pretty, I mean, they're pretty good in battle. Like Dwalin especially seems like a pretty
yes.
Pretty effective fighter. But still, these are the guys that came, and there is there's that exchange between Thorin and Balin later in this scene where Balin kind of tries to let Thorin off the hook and says, you don't have to do this.
Yeah.
And I thought that scene was awesome. Like all of that stuff was my favorite stuff in the film.
Yeah.
The character moments with the dwarves, like, I think they did a great job of showing that these guys all sort of are special in that they showed up and that they're gonna do this for Thorin, and that most of them, I think, are well aware of the fact that they probably don't stand a chance, and that this is probably not gonna work.
And it also I think strengthens what Gandalf says towards the end of the scene, where he's like, you know, there is a strength in you that you're not even aware of, and of course this first of all applies to Bilbo. But it also applies to the dwarves. These dwarves are going to be much more heroic than they themselves thought they could be. And even Thorin, in a way, discovers his own strength along this story. And I think it's in that last iconic scene where he stands up against Azog that you can fully see that he is embracing this inner strength. And up to that moment, he just didn't realize it was there, and I love that because I think that is a very Tolkien-like theme where it's all about, it's not the strong ones that determine the fate of Middle-earth ultimately. It's in what is weak, in what is foolish, that redemption lies. Which of course I think is something that that Tolkien takes from his own Christian background, where, you know, even that line that. Gandalf keeps saying, and even what the dwarves themselves know, is like, you're a bunch of fools, you know, run, you fools, or come over here, you fools. That whole idea of this is a bunch of fools, but yet they are, it's what's foolish that is ultimately stronger than, you know, what is strong in the eyes of, let's say, a Saruman or a Sauron.
Mm-hmm. I think also what you can see, especially when you compare it to Saruman, is that pride and his whole attitude the clouds is his judgment.
Yes.
And the dwarves and Bilbo, because they don't know a lot, and maybe they are foolish, but that they because of that they have an open vision, so they can see more solutions than, for example, someone who like Saruman, who thinks he knows everything and is very wise. He just says, "Well, this is not possible," and then he doesn't want to think about it anymore.
Well, and that there is also this whole aspect of them almost unwillingly being involved in this adventure, and there, I think there's a great let's say dichotomy between Saruman and Gandalf, and I think that Tolkien actually wrote it like this: is that Saruman is the wizard who tries to control everything, and even micromanage everything, and by that he tries to dominate, whereas Gandalf is almost the let's say the symbol of providence, where you feel that there's a plan, but there is a lot of margin in this plan for freedom. And so that is, I think, why Gandalf refuses to, you know, to stop the rain from falling. It's that is not his job. He is thinking along much bigger lines than everyone else. And it's a kind of plan that even depends, I think, on the freedom of the people involved. And so it's this lack of control, both with the dwarves and with Bilbo. And then yet, bit by bit, they do realize that they are part of a plan and that if they are faithful to their calling, then it's going to work out. Whereas Saruman is more, the more he tries to control and the more he tries to use violence, the less he is successful. I think that is a very fundamental theme in the entire, you know, Middle Earth story saga.
That's very, very true. Gandalf's orientation toward these events is one of humility, right?
Like, yes.
And that's one thing I think they actually even do a good job of hinting at that in this film, where Galadriel asks him, like, why the Hobbit? And he basically says, I don't know.
Yeah.
And you see this throughout the book, this sort of this sense of like Gandalf is tapped into something greater than himself, and he's kind of going along with the flow. One way to interpret it is that he trusts his instincts and his intuitions. You know, very Luke Skywalker-ish.
Well, in a way, it's about faith. This entire story, this especially the first story, which I think is kind of like a vocation story for a lot of the characters involved, but it is also a story of having faith that if you play your part and the others do as well, that is the way to go. And so Gandalf asks Thorin's faith. It's like, trust me. Says it explicitly, because Thorin is like, this is not what I want. And then Gandalf is, you have to trust me on this. And then the same thing is happening to Bilbo, where Bilbo is asked to, despite his fears and his reluctance, is like, just trust it. You are meant to do this. And it's like the calling of the prophets in the Bible. They all say no in the beginning. They're all like, yeah, you got the wrong hobbit. And then if they still are faithful and they dare to trust that this will lead to something, then that's the moment when the story starts to move forward. And I love that the acting of Martin Freeman, I think, was amazing. This ongoing tension that you see in his eyes, but also his curiosity. And there are two moments when this becomes very apparent, and he's just in the background, but you know, his eyes say so much. It's when this map is shown by Gandalf. And it's, by the way, exactly the same map that we see in the first movie, The Fellowship of the Ring of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. That same map is in Bilbo's room when Gandalf enters. And at that, when I first saw that movie, I didn't recognize the map. And you see Gandalf looking at that map, and it's almost as if he thinks back of things in the past. And now that I've seen this movie, the Unexpected Journey, and I rewatched The Fellowship of the Ring, it's almost as if Peter Jackson somehow intuitively knew that he was going to tell this story of the Hobbit. And it's right there in the acting. I don't know how, it's like the magic of sometimes how that works with actors. They had no clue that they would be doing The Hobbit so many years later, and yet it is already there. But the only thing that they changed a little bit is that in the scene in Fellowship of the Ring is at daylight. It's actually in the morning. So there's sunlight on a map, and this dragon, for instance, is very red, whereas here it's in the evening, so it's all the map has kind of muted colors and all seems a bit brownish. But I thought it was amazing. Even the X, the little mark there for the other entrance, it's already on the other map in Fellowship of the Ring as well. It's already there. So you can tell that Bilbo is like, oh, a map, I want to see this. And then later on, when they start to sing, he is on the ledge of his bed, just listening to those songs. And I think that's where the Took side of him is awakened.
That's also in a book, that the Song of the Dwarves awakens the Took side.
Wasn't it lovely how they did that visually with the little sparks of fire, you know, going up in the sky? It was just almost this... I don't know. It's what is it? Tinkerbell uses this magic dust. It was like, this is the call to adventure. It's like, you know, dare to step into that dark night and follow where, you know, your imagination leads you. I thought it was fantastically done. Yep. And then the next morning, another great scene. Bilbo wakes up, and so do we with Bilbo, and it's like silent, and he walks around in his house, and I just love that sequence where
it's like almost that he misses the company. Like, oh, yeah, so nice and nice and cozy.
At first,
night,
he just
and
looks
I'm all alone again.
He's that's almost awesome. Like half afraid that they will still be there, and then he sees that his entire kitchen is completely cleaned and nothing is broken. Everything is there, and you see him making that arm gesture, is like yes, and then he's like, okay, so what now? And he looks around, and then the very subtle. And that's why I love the camera direction on this as well. You see him walking around, and he walks into the same room where the evening before he was sitting there with Gandalf, you know, near the chimney. And he looks around, and he's just like, his hands are flappy. He's like, what do I do? And then slowly the camera reveals the front door of Bag End. And that's... that whole scene, and you don't even see the face of Martin Freeman, but by seeing that door, you feel like that door is pulling him. It's the door becomes the symbol of this calling to adventure. And the next scene is this running scene where he's like, okay, I'm going on an adventure. Which, by the way, I love him running around and jumping over things and almost stepping onto the chickens. By the way, are those like extra small chickens? They just looked very small to me for, you know, considering that the hobbits in the scene are also very small.
I didn't even really notice. I'm terrible at noticing details like that.
But then you see the scene where he's running through this little, what is it? There are two hills on both sides of this small road. And... I even didn't recognize Martin Freeman. I was wondering if it was like that they just pasted in his face or something like that. He looked different to me, but that whole scene was very much modified and especially in colors. It looked beautiful, but also a bit surreal because I remember from being there on a very similar sunny morning that it looked quite different, the Shire. But a beautiful. I love the whole depiction of the Shire, and it also what I appreciated was that it looked slightly different from the Shire that we saw in The Lord of the Rings. Mostly it was messier, and there were constantly hobbits in the background, even when you have that conversation between Gandalf and Bilbo where Gandalf was like, come on, you don't recognize me, I'm Gandalf. Every time we see Gandalf in the left corner of the screen, you see this female hobbit doing the laundry, and she's just barely there, but it adds this little bit of life to the scene. And the entire sequence was like that. It's just a lot going on, and you almost have the feeling that the rest of the Shire is completely unaware of what is happening to Bilbo. And there are only a few of the hobbits that are, you know, even noticing that he runs off. So no wonder that later on they're like, okay, let's just, you know, sell his stuff, because we have no idea where this guy went. And then you see him running with that long, long contract, running after the dwarves and Gandalf. And of course, they're all very disappointed. And I told you so. And then Bilbo is like, oh, I want to come along with you. There was another brilliant moment. And again, it's like almost, I think, by accident that it happened, where Bilbo, you know, he hands in his contract that he signed. And the moment we switch to the over-the-shoulder shot of, I think it's Balin who checks the document and it's like, it's okay. That moment, you see the head of the pony turning towards Bilbo, and you can very briefly, this is just a fraction of a second, you see Bilbo or Martin Freeman just stepping away. He's like, oh, that's a big animal. And then the sequence after that is that give him a pony. They force him on this pony. And I just love it. I don't think you can direct something like that, like a pony just turning his head towards your main actor in that scene. But it happened, and it was just very subtle acting there.
I also love the shot when he's actually riding the pony and he's completely uncomfortable.
Yes, he's almost like trying to steer that pony. And then apparently they had all these wagers and all the betting that was going on. And again, it was kind of the Gandalf the Grey side that you see where even Gandalf placed a bet. I just love that. And the scene with the handkerchief. Is that in a book?
Yes.
That was brilliant.
Yeah. It was done a little bit differently. The thing that was in the book was him complaining. I don't think that the book featured a dwarf tearing off a piece of his saddle blanket or whatever and throwing it to him. But that was a nice little addition. I like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. Well, and then just the type of things that Bilbo at the beginning of this adventure still thinks about is like, stop, everyone. I forgot my handkerchief.
Yep. Yeah.
And then you've got the beautiful scene with the voiceover by Ian McKellen, like, oh, there will be a lot of other things that you have to leave behind, dear Bilbo. And it's this beautiful, I'm not sure if it's a crane shot or a helicopter shot, but you have these rocky, this rock side, mountainside on the left side of the screen, and there's this little river. And I remember having seen exactly this same landscape in one of the production videos, and I remember yes. that we had a discussion of, you know, what part of the book could this be and what could it represent. And I think we had some very elaborate theories about this, but it was just, you know, part of the Shire area. It's just, you know, just whatever, some beautiful landscape. And for all of you that have never been to New Zealand, I can tell you that New Zealand, actually, especially the Northern Island around Matamata, looks exactly like this. It is stunningly beautiful, and you've got these landscapes full of green hills, and it's beautiful. The only thing that takes you out of Middle Earth is, you know, the occasional lamppost or you know gas station, but the rest looks exactly like this. So I don't think that they had to do much enhancement of these scenes. And then what happens? It starts
the trolls.
Is it the troll? Well, it starts to rain.
Yeah.
And then there's this nice exchange of the dwarves, like, hey, Gandalf, do something. And Gandalf is, you need another wizard for this. You know, it just rains and it stops when it stops. So it's, again, this humility, but also this, like, just abandon yourself, dude. Just don't try to control everything. And I think just that one line of you need another wizard for that is a direct reference to Saruman. And I don't think we probably already mentioned that last week as well. We see
and
him
also, I also love the fact that he could not think about a name for the two blue wizards. He had to laugh or laugh.
Oh, yeah. What did you think about that, Dave? Wasn't that hilarious?
Oh, the blue wizards?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a nice little reference to the fact that they don't own the rights. I thought that was really amusing. And it's actually something that I think a lot of not fanatics didn't catch. A lot of people just assumed that they don't. I even had a few friends who were actually huge Tolkien fans who thought that was a reference to the fact that Tolkien never named the Blue Wizards. And I was like, oh, no. He named them just in books they don't own the rights to. So I thought that was cute.
There's one other thing that I forgot to ask you guys. This happens on the evening of the arrival of the dwarves, and at one point one of the dwarves asks Gandalf how many dragons he has slayed, and he almost chokes in his, you know, in his pipe. And it looks as if the dwarves get angry with Gandalf. Or is it just that, I don't know, they're unsettled? It felt a bit weird. I didn't understand what happened there. All of a sudden, there's as if this is a big deal, how many dragons he has slayed.
I think Thorin or someone has called in for his aid to get rid of this dragon. Mm-hmm. And Gandalf came up with this problem, with this solution. And they assumed that Gandalf, being this old, was the master. So he had experience with slaying these big dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there are other stories by Tolkien about slaying big dragons.
Mm-hmm.
But they are in the Silmarillion, if I remember correctly. So they cannot elaborate on that.
Oh, you think that's another way for them to kind of avoid the rights issue?
But you cannot talk about other big dragons in the history of Middle-earth because that's in the Silmarillion.
Yeah, that is a good point. I you know, like, obviously Gandalf didn't really participate in any of those, but that is an interesting point. They can't talk about it either. The only one they could talk about is the one that gets mentioned in the appendix of the Lord of the Rings is
right.
What the heck is the name of that dragon? There's a dragon that that is slain by the Rohirrim. And they took a bunch of his dwarf treasure, and it leads to a dispute between the Rohirrim and the dwarves.
Oh.
Dang it! What is the name of that dragon?
I'm googling right now.
But
don't
anyway,
worry.
Yeah, it's not worth going into. We have so much to cover. But that is a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
I don't think there's in the Silmarillion there's this dragon that's been slain by an elf. I think one of the
which one. If you're talking about oh my god, I can't remember that. Glaurung.
Yeah.
He's like the most famous dragon. He's the father of dragons. He's killed by the great human warrior Turin Turambar in Tolkien's sort of most tragic tale. But he's not. I mean, it's Gandalf wasn't actually Gandalf wasn't even in Middle Earth at the time of that. So it's not. You know, he wasn't really involved in that anyway. But mm-hmm. but yeah, they there's no way they could mention that on screen other than the fact that there seems to be later in the book, Smaug has a really disturbing dream about a great warrior with a bright, shining, sharp sword sticking him in the belly. And that's how Glaurung died. So a lot of folks think that that's actually kind of Smaug having kind of a nightmare about how his great-great-great-great-grandfather Glaurung died. So there's the possibility they might include elements of that, this reference to those events that, mm-hmm. that seems to be in The Hobbit, but no, they could never mention him by name. Oh,
that's why, by the way, now that you mentioned dreams, that was an interesting omission of what they could have done, but perhaps it would have made the entire, like, first part of the movie too long. But I kind of remember that there was a discussion between Gandalf and Thorin about a dream that they had together, or like they had the same dream, and it had to do with this quest. But I'm not sure. Perhaps this might have taken place even before the two of them get together again in the Shire, because they've met before, of course.
Oh man, a dream. I don't remember that. There is in the appendix, The Lord of the Rings, in the quest for Erebor. It turns out that Gandalf and Thorin have actually had multiple meetings,
yes,
and discussions about this, which they do a good job of hinting at in the film. Mm-hmm. I don't remember a discussion about a dream. That's possible.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Are those the meetings in Bree?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yep. And Gandalf also goes to visit Thorin's current home in the Blue Mountains as well.
Cool. Hey, by the way, if our listeners want to hear more about the dragons in the world of Tolkien in Middle Earth, we recorded, and this is a while ago, we recorded an entire episode of our other podcast dedicated to Tolkien, which is called Secrets of Middle Earth. We did episode 12 entirely about dragons. And the cool thing is we actually venture into an area in Middle Earth where these dragons are still there, and I think that there's even a dragon that episode. So go check it out, middleearth.sqpn.com, and look for episode 12. It was a lot of fun recording that. So they continue their journey, and then we get to the trolls already, but not before they halt and isn't that, don't they come across this burnt down farm?
It's a farm with farmers which were taken by the trolls. So the trolls have raided that farm.
Right.
And Gandalf looks around and he recognizes the traces of mountain trolls being active. So you can see the expression on his face that he doesn't trust the situation and he really thinks they should move.
But of course,
he suspects being trolls being in a neighborhood.
The dwarves are very stubborn. Thorin doesn't want to hear about going to Rivendell. And it's the first time that we see Gandalf really mad and angry and frustrated. It's like, these stubborn dwarves, I'm going to meet the only person that makes sense here. And then Bilbo's like, who's that? Well, that would be me. Great, great humor. And it shows that even Gandalf has his, you know, there are limits to his patience.
Isn't this also the scene where the flashback to the Battle of Azanul Bazar?
I don't know about that. We see the scene with the soup, and then I think we go straight to the trolls. I'm not sure when that happened.
The Azanul Bazar scene happens before the trolls.
Isn't it when they are like taking shelter and
It's the first night that they're kind of camping,
right,
sort of up on the hills and stuff.
The one where Filly and Keeley try to scare Bilbo with the
orcs. Yeah, about
the orcs.
You know, oh, there's orcs in them mountains.
Yes, you think that's funny? And it's that long heroic scene where we get to understand that Thorin is indeed a leader and how he became a leader. And it's a nice narrative by Balin. And it shows them at a much younger age, and I really like this flashback. Very similar to the way in which they went back to the prologue several times in Fellowship of the Ring, and they did the same thing here, where you know we get to see Azog and we see the end of what's his name, Thror, being beheaded, which was kind of graphic. With the head rolling by, and then Thorin is like, ah!
Yeah. it's not as graphic as in the book, because I think also in the book there was something carved on his head, and then it was sent back to the dwarves.
Hmm.
Yep. It's very they changed his death. In the book, his death takes place before any battle occurs, and that in fact the entire Battle of Azanul Bazar and the entire war of the dwarves and the goblins is instigated by by Azog's murder of Thror.
Mm.
But I think this worked. I think this was a great way to. There's no way they were going to be able to portray all of that on screen, like that narrative. That would have been too complicated. Yeah. So this was a great way of doing it. I think was very interesting, and I think it worked. And I think it's also doing it. It was a great way to sort of very efficiently motivate the enmity between Thror and Azog's orcs and whatnot.
And later Thorin and Azog, because Thorin is the one who cuts off his arm.
I thought that was very interesting. What's conspicuous in all of that is, where the heck is Thrain? Like,
I was like, he's missing in action. They keep talking about him, but just show me that dwarf.
Yes.
And of course, in the original story, that's Thor, of course, loopy because of the ring he possibly had in position. Mm-hmm. So he had this idea to go with his servant to Moria to reclaim Moria. So in the original story, there were just the two of them, Thor and his servant.
Okay.
And they walked into Moria like, this is our home. And then Azog was like, yeah. And then he decapitated him and carved some message in his head and sent it to the kin.
Yes.
And then the whole kin and all the dwarves showed up at Moria to learn him a lesson. That's basically what really happened.
It's like the second time that this movie at least refers to a beheading, because we have that interesting scene in Bag End with the what was it, the great uncle of or great great uncle of Bilbo, who apparently had decapitated that king of the
Took.
Yes,
that's also a real story in
I know, I remember that. We talked about it also in Secrets of Middle Earth with the invention of the
Game of
the game of golf. But I love the way, and I think this added with Bilbo saying, I think you made that up. It's like, so, totally incredulous. Well, yes. Every good story needs a bit of, what is it, embellishment?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a nice kind of meta reference to sort of the idea that Jackson is changing Tolkien's story a bit.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Actually, that might have been. That's a good point. I totally missed that. That might have been kind of an inside joke. Just embellishing the story. But anyway, we see this beheading. We see Azog being dragged off, you know, being hurt. And then, of course, the dwarves, for whatever reason, just assume that he died of his wounds, even though I was like, yeah, how can you be so sure?
No, and he's probably still alive. You know?
Yeah, yeah. It's probably wishful thinking.
I think the one thing about mm-hmm. the whole Battle of Azenome, obviously I was thrilled that they included it. Mm-hmm. I thought that was, you know, that was beyond all hope that they would actually include that scene for me. The one kind of weird thing about it is sort of this, you know, they went to reclaim Moria and there's sort of this like, well, why didn't they reclaim it? You know what I mean? Yeah. It was like we cut off Azog's arm. He rallied us. We fought back. We pushed them back. And then it's like, why didn't you recapture Moria? Like what? It just kind of ends with the battle ending. We beat them. We didn't actually get Moria, but we still beat them, kind of.
But I think
I thought that was confusing. I imagine most viewers probably didn't bother to worry about that too much. Most of them were thinking, when are we going to actually get back to the movie instead of recounting obscure historical events?
Well,
and then most fans like us filled in the knowledge that we already had, which we've discussed before, but I thought that was kind of odd. Maybe that's something that in an extended version of the scene, there'll be an extra 5 to 10 minutes of them explaining, about the Balrog and all that, or, you know, maybe even savvy movie fans will fill that in like, oh, hey, wasn't there a Balrog in there or something? But they didn't discuss that at all.
No.
And I thought it was kind of, a weird ending to the battle. We won. Not really.
Well, but I think it is because this flashback story-wise is not there to give us more historical background on the dwarves.
Right.
This was
to motivate the
it's a personal story. Well, not even that. Well, it's to introduce Azog, but it's also to
demonstrate
tell
Thorin's
why Balin was how he discovered Thorin as their new leader. It's like
that's a good point.
It's beheading of our first king, and then Thrain just dashes off and is afraid. And so Thorin was the only brave guy who's left. And I love the introduction of his oaken shield.
Yeah.
The way they played that out.
True to the story.
Fantastic. But I loved it. It's just, because if you read it, you're like, yeah, whatever. A piece of just, you know, a branch of a tree as a shield. But visually, it totally worked. It was very believable. It's the only thing around. So he used that to defend himself. And if I'm not mistaken, he still carries around that piece of wood. Because in the end battle between him and Azog, he uses it again. And then when he gets picked up by one of the eagles, he drops it. And then you see that it's actually a fortified piece of wood. There is a handle on it. And so it apparently became his shield of choice after this
big battle.
Yeah,
that was a little odd. it's really, you know, like he used it in the battle because he had to. It really doesn't make that great of a shield.
Well, but I think that if you look carefully, he actually strengthened it.
He turned it into a thing he could wear on his arm, almost like a glaive.
Yeah.
But it's still like, you could still make a better shield,
yes.
However, it was a really nice character moment, right? Because it essentially was sort of him kind of leaving the past behind, in a sense. You're moving on to you're dropping the oaken shield meant in some sense leaving that behind.
Oh sure,
like
yeah,
time to move on to bigger and better things. I'm sure that's why they did it. It was totally a character moment.
Yeah. I liked it. So then we see Thorin, and we get introduced to let's say Azog's party, and this is something I didn't understand the first time I saw the movie. But later on, I was like, oh, they're still hunting for Thorin. That's why there's all these nasty dwarves. And apparently, Azog is out for revenge, and he wants to track down this dwarf that has cut off his arm. And so they're being chased. It's kind of nice. Yeah. Almost like a parallel to the fellowship being chased by the ringwraiths.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I liked about it is that it gives the story a sense of urgency. So you cannot just do a kind of a tourist route to Erebor, mm-hmm. or wander around and admire the flowers, but because you're being chased. And also it also kind of explains, for example, why the orcs came down from the mountains, because they recall at White Council that there's peace for 400 years. So why would there be orcs coming down from the mountains,
yes,
other than chasing the dwarves? So that ties in that nicely.
It's still a bit strange that it took them so long to find the dwarves, because how many years before the events of The Hobbit does this Battle of Azanulbazar take place?
Oh yeah, there's hundreds.
Okay.
And Elrond refers to, you know, like 400 years of peace and stuff. I think that's meant to be a mystery. Like, why now, essentially? And I think for those of us who are speculating about it and familiar with the books, I think what we probably have in mind is that all of these events more than likely are being orchestrated by the necromancer, by Sauron. There's probably some coordination. I mean, that was one of the big questions, mm-hmm. that I was left with at the end of this film was, wow, there are a lot of villains.
Yes.
Like there's,
yes,
Azog and his orcs. There's all, you know, the great goblins kind of a mm-hmm. pseudo villain. But he's not necessarily working in concert with anybody. There's a necromancer and what he's doing at Dol Guldur, and he's obviously manipulating the spiders, whereas in the books the spiders were just kind of there. And then there's Smaug, and Gandalf hints at the idea that, like, the reason we need to do something about Smaug is to keep him from coordinating with other forces that are at work. And I assume that one of the big reveals is going to be that the necromancer actually is stirring the pot. If he's not giving orders to Azog, then certainly he may be instigated events. You know, he passed along a message. Hey, you know, might be interested. Thorin's going to be out in the middle of the wilderness, guarded by only 13 other dwarves. This is could be a good chance to go for him. So I don't think this was a matter of, like, it took them hundreds of years to find him. I think this is a question of, like, timing. You know, right when Thorin going on the road like this makes himself completely vulnerable. And somebody probably reached out to Azog and said, hey, you should probably go for him. Maybe even compelled him. Maybe said, you know, you work for me, go do this. Yeah. I think that's probably the direction they're heading in.
Yeah, I also, I think that Tolkien discussed about almost that the ring has as a mind of its own. So at one point, the ring kind of knows that it's not going anywhere with Gollum. So then the ring escapes, basically, and finds Bilbo, setting all the rest of the events in history in motion. So I also was thinking maybe Sauron is kind of looking for his, sort of the forces of evil are kind of pushing to the climax, which is in the end of Lord of the Rings already. The beginnings of that are already seen in The Hobbit.
Very well possible.
Yeah,
we're approaching the end of our show
there
already.
There's no chance we're going to finish at this pace.
Hey, just trust me.
We'll get to the Lonely Mountain.
I think that this part of the movie was really good. And I really liked the introduction of Azog. The only thing that I missed was Bolg. I was so convinced that they would set up this whole, you know, Bolg looking for his father and then Azog being around, Bolg being unaware of that. I thought they would set it up in this movie. But
I'm certain they're going to kill Azog before the end.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think he's going to die next movie, actually.
And Bolg is going to, that's going to be his reason to, you know, hate the dwarves and everything.
I will say, I personally think the Azog scenes didn't. I think it's a good idea because it pushes the company along and it really builds up sort of the motivates the final battle with the goblins. But I think some of those scenes just didn't work. Like the scenes of them chasing Radagast. I think when all is said and done, I'm gonna wish that I'd had those 15 minutes to spend on something else.
Totally.
We'll definitely talk about Radagast and his bunny sled in our next episode, as well as the trolls. We're gonna begin our next show with the three trolls, which were working so much better than I hoped for. But all that's coming up soon in the next part of our review. Yeah, we might have another three-parter ahead of us. We'll see. So far, so good. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Secrets of the Hobbit. Now, if you're a new listener, and I'm actually very surprised and also happy that we are picking up a lot more listeners now that the movie is out. And you want to hear our discussions about, well, how this movie came to be. And this is not just about the production. We also talk a lot about the story. Just go to thehobbit.sqpn.com. And every show has extensive show notes and a title, a descriptive title. So you might want to sample one of those older shows. I think it's a lot of fun to just go back and see our discussions, and then knowing what, of course, the movie ultimately would do. So go check that out at thehobbit.sqpn.com. I also mentioned the other Tolkien-related podcast series that I co-host with Inge. And that is Secrets of Middle-earth, which you can find at middleearth.sqpn.com. middleearth.sqpn.com. And then finally, to wrap things up, Dave can also be found in many productions of the Middle-earth Network, most specifically the Riddles in the Dark podcast, which is one of the best ones out there because it's all about speculating what's going to end up in the movies and whatnot, and why not, or why it will be in the movies. And, well, it's a prediction game. And, well, Dave, can you already reveal a little bit? Have you been counting the scores of all these Tolkien
people? I haven't counted up the official analyst scores, so folks like you, but I will say that the Tolkien professor and I and our other co-host Trish all did terrible compared to the listeners.
Oh,
like, most of the listeners beat us.
All right.
We were incredibly good at coming up with good questions, terrible at answering them.
All right, well, go check it out at the Middle Earth Network. And we will be back soon with another episode of The Secrets of Middle-earth. Thank you for listening, and so long.